Have you ever wondered if anyone can explain how the sausage gets made by our legislature? Well over 1,000 bills are introduced each session, but less than 100 pass, almost all in last-minute chaos. We then wait weeks for reporters to sort out why, what, and how all this happened. Well, today we get an insider's account by the author of Inside the New Mexico Senate, former Albuquerque North Valley Senator Dee Dee Feldman. Dee Dee Feldman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Steve.
You know, Dee Dee, there's so much from your book that I'd like to ask you about. Why, for example, the Democrat-controlled Senate can't seem to always pass Democrat-oriented bills, the actual impact of lobbyists on the process, and the overall issue of corruption, which you talk a lot about in your book. But let's start with why the last-minute chaos each session. It doesn't seem to matter if it's a 30-day or a 60-day. Everything seems to come down to the last minute and the last few days.
Well, the sessions are very short, and there's no limit on the number of bills that any senator or House member can introduce. And so, you know, given the process, there are, as you said, sometimes there are 2,000 bills.
Yes.
In a long session, and the long session isn't very long. It's 60 days. So, you know, by the end of the first two or three weeks, when we hear all of the mariachis and the ballet folklorico and all of the, you know, memorials and the honorings and so on are done, then we have a few days maybe to consider stuff that does make it to the floor. And remember, it has to go through committees before it makes it to the floor.
This committee process, to me, seems a little bizarre because certainly the federal Congress doesn't work this way, and the states that I'm familiar with don't work this way, where every bill seems to go to three or four committees. Each senator there's 10 senators on a committee or so, and the committees have to hear each bill. I mean, it's just a recipe for delay, it seems to.
Well, but it's also a recipe for good legislation because you want something that's well thought out. You want something that people can agree on once it gets to the floor. Most of the bills that get to the floor have been worked over and are amended, and then they pass fairly easily once they get to the floor, with one caveat, and that is if they're scheduled by the majority leader. Sometimes there's a big bottleneck because the majority leader doesn't allow certain bills to be heard for strategic reasons, or because he doesn't like the bill, or because he's using it as a bargaining chip until something comes over from the House. So, you know, I do think that almost all legislative bodies use the same process, including the U.S. Congress.
Well, the Congress, it usually goes to one or two committees. Here, it can go to three or four committees. If it goes to four committees,
it's dead.
It's dead, exactly.
It is dead.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly.
And that's when you know that the leadership doesn't like your bill, when you have it assigned to three or four committees. Well, the reason is because by our rules, it's only supposed to go to two committees in the Senate. But if it has a fiscal impact, a third committee can be added to that, and that is the Finance Committee.
Okay. So you've actually raised something that I want to shift to, and that is why the Democrat-controlled legislature, and specifically the Democrat-controlled Senate. And there's been a huge majority of Democrats in the Senate for a long time, right?
Yes, but you have to look at the composition of the Senate. And yes, there have been more Democrats, but they're often conservative Democrats. They're Democrats from down in the southern part of the state or the eastern part of the state. And the Senate has always been prone to coalitions. And there's a coalition right now. There was a coalition when I was there for most of the time. And it's a coalition between Republicans and conservative Democrats. And the conservative Democrats, because they're Democrats, usually get the leadership positions. And the Republicans go along knowing it could be much worse.
Yeah, so you sort of answered the question I didn't quite get out, which is why Democrats can't pass liberal Democratic legislation. And if anyone doubts your view of the composition of the Senate, I guess we can talk about Mary Kay Papin being Senate pro tem because that sort of proves it, right?
Mary Kay Papin is the product of an implicit coalition. Although the president pro tem vote did not happen between the actual nominee of the Democratic caucus, who was Senator Pete Campos from Las Vegas, and Senator Mary Kay Papin, though, had the votes because she had four or five Democrats, and then she had all of the Republicans. But to save face, the Democratic leadership did not allow that vote to happen, and Senator Campos graciously nominated Senator Papin. But the reality was that behind the scenes, there was a coalition. And if you look at some of the votes in the ensuing 2 years, you can see that coalition in action.
And it's about, there's about 18 Republicans or so, and all they need is like
three or four conservative
Democrats.
That's right.
And then they control
the pro tem position. The president pro tempore is the official name. Is elected by the whole Senate. Unlike the majority leader, which is elected by the Democratic caucus, the majority whip is elected by that caucus, as is the minority whip and the minority leader. So the president pro tem, if they're smart candidates, and they almost always have been, is reaching across the aisle and trying to get support if they're not supported by a unanimous caucus.
And the point really is not only that Mary Kay Papin, a conservative Democrat, is the pro tem of the Senate, but that actually shows you the center of gravity of the Senate.
Yes, right? It does show you that.
It shows you where the real power is, because that coalition of Republicans and conservative Democrats really control legislation.
Yes, and it is a continuation, basically, of President pro tem Tim Jennings' coalition, which was exactly the same. And Mary Kay Papin, not exactly because there are new members, but Mary Kay Papin was one of the swing votes, you see, that supported Tim Jennings when he became pro tem, even though the nominee of the Democratic caucus was someone else.
I see. And actually, one of the weirdest things that happened was that here was Tim Jennings, who was constantly fighting with Governor Johnson and then constantly fighting with Governor Richardson. And he then is the one selected by the Martinez administration and by their PAC to be knocked out of contention.
Go figure. I think that's just, you know, probably sort of out of state, independent money, not really knowing the situation in New Mexico. I could be wrong about that, but it would have been smarter probably for the governor to, you know, let that one ride and focus on some of the other races.
But I want to push you on this idea that this conservative coalition of Republicans and conservative Democrats really necessarily control the Senate because, and I'm sure you're aware of this because you wrote about it, there was a period of time, which you talk about in your book, when that same coalition was possible, but the Senate passed progressive Democratic legislation, and that was the period when Manny Aragon was the president pro tem of the Senate, correct?
Right. But remember, Manny, and he was there for a long time, I think 1993 or maybe earlier, maybe the late 80s, till 2001. He had a Republican governor to contend with, and that was Gary Johnson. That was a barrier. Besides Manny Aragon, there was also another Democratic president pro tem, during which there was a small window of when a lot of stuff got done, and that was Ben Altamirano from Silver City, who was president pro tem after Richard Romero left. And Richard Romero was the product of a coalition as well.
Yeah, I mean, it was like, I think, three conservative Democrats, all the rest of the Republicans, they ousted Manny Aragon,
yes,
and put in Richard Romero.
Yes, but it was an unusual coalition because those were not conservative Democrats. Those were Cisco McSorley,
yes,
Leonard Soce, and Richard Romero himself. And
well, hadn't Richard Romero been a Republican?
Yes, a long time previously he had been a Republican. But the driving force behind that coalition was the desire to oust Manny Aragon. And there were Democrats who were willing to, I mean, it's a very risky thing to be a part of a coalition with Republicans for Democrats.
Right. If you fail, especially,
yes,
you're going to pay
fail,
for it.
Your legislation will not do well and your committee assignments will suffer.
Okay, so let me just mention, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. We're talking about Inside the New Mexico Senate, a recently published book by Dee Dee Feldman. And Dee Dee Feldman is our guest. And I guess, Dee Dee, the question really was that I wanted to get at was, how was Manny able to do this, given the composition of the Senate at that time, which still had the same 18 or so Republicans? How was he able to pass progressive legislation? And sort of the question really is, why can't Michael Sanchez do it now? So that, you know, how would you compare and contrast those situations?
Well, they're entirely different. Manny, it might be interesting for your listeners to know that Manny came to power through a coalition.
Yeah, that's one of the strangest things.
Manny came to power through a coalition and was elected by Republicans as well as Democrats, and even made some Republicans committee chairs, something that Richard Romero never did. It was an entirely different thing. He consolidated power once he got in as a coalition candidate. After that, then every year after that, he was elected by the Democratic caucus, who went for a majority for him, a unanimous, actually, for him. It certainly was true in 1997, my first year. And so he had a united force behind him, and people were extraordinarily loyal to him, loyal perhaps beyond what they should have been. And there was a democratically controlled House. Raymond Sanchez was the speaker at that time. But that allowed him to pass a lot of what we consider far-reaching legislation today, reforming Medicaid, expanding it to include a lot more women and children, passing a Patient Protection Act, passing mental health parity, which didn't pass at the federal level until 2009 or so. So he was able to do that. And even though there was a Republican governor, Governor Johnson, for most of that time, Governor Johnson was kind of a libertarian rather than a sort of party line Republican. And so, you know, his sort of idiosyncratic nature, although they were arch enemies, he might sign some of that legislation.
Now, Manny Aragon has a well-deserved terrible reputation because he ends up getting involved in a scandal. He goes to prison. He raked off at least $640,000 from the Metropolitan Courthouse construction. But at the time when he was president pro tem, he was regarded as like an LBJ-type
yes.
figure, right? And you've got a part of your book where Joe Carrero, a Republican senator, mm-hmm. I believe, talks about Manny. And I wonder if you could read that, a short paragraph for us from your book.
Okay, I'd be happy to, Steve. I have a chapter about different leadership styles in the Senate, and Manny's was pretty unique, but there were others as well that were covered here. And the key question I had was why? Why were people so fanatically loyal to Manny?
They loved him.
They loved Manny, and even after, you know, he was convicted, people still love him. I mean, he, you know, most people think he's just a dastardly fellow, but he really did a lot of good in New Mexico. I really want to say that. But, you know, something went to his head. Something went terribly wrong. But that didn't characterize his entire career. Anyway, he often left the Democratic senators in the lurch. We didn't know what he was doing because he kept his cards kind of close to the vest until the last minute, and we could only hope that it was going to be a good outcome. So here's a passage from the book. Despite the surprises, almost all of the Democrats stuck with him. It left us dangling, Senator Roman Maez of Santa Fe said of the 1997 debacle, which was when the session ended with a total crash.
Yeah, someone had backed out of a deal, and Manny just cratered the session.
A filibuster ensued with Bill Davis, a senator from the Heights of Albuquerque, talking for hours about communism and other topics. But anyway, we didn't know what was going on, but Senator Roman Maez of Santa Fe said, "But Manny, you've just got to rely on him. The guy had it all," said Republican Senator Joe Carraro, who had returned to the Senate in 1993 after a four-year absence. He was a one-man political machine. He was thinking many steps ahead. He was a chess master. The others were still playing checkers, but Manny was brilliant, and I loved him. Carraro said he was always ended his speeches, especially those diametrically opposed to Manny's position, with the phrase, "And I love you, man." But soon Manny lost his smile and Carraro noticed a change in tone.
And that really alludes to the overthrow of Manny. But one thing about Manny that I wanted to bring up with you is that he was a walking conflict of interest. You talk about this in your book. I mean, he was a national lobbyist, a federal lobbyist for Wackenhut, a prison corporation, and he continued to vote on prison legislation.
There are senators now who are lobbyists at the federal level and continue to vote.
So you name names in your book, and you talk about some of these conflicts, and I wondered if you would tell our audience about some of these conflicts.
The problem is we have a citizens' legislature, and the citizens' legislature allows the members to keep their day jobs. They are bankers. They are insurance guys. They are auditors. They are appraisers. And sometimes they're voting on the things that will be affecting directly their businesses. Yet very rarely do senators recuse themselves from votes. It's almost like the rest of the senators actually look to the doctor to be the expert on medical stuff, or they look to the insurance guy to be the expert on insurance without that bright line. This is why we need an ethics commission. Without that bright line that would define when a senator could vote and when he couldn't vote.
So let's talk specifically about some of these conflicts that you bring up.
Well, John Ryan, for example, from the North Valley of Albuquerque, is a lobbyist at the national level, and he represents, I think, some cities in eastern New Mexico, or towns, I should say, in eastern New Mexico on water matters before the federal government. But he also sits on the water committees in the New Mexico Senate and is called upon to vote upon those issues and whether their money should be appropriated to his town that is a client of his to do a water diversion project. And there are others that have contracts in the oil and gas field, and we are always considering regulation of pollution resulting from oil and gas, and they have no compunction about voting on those issues.
Yeah, and you mentioned, I think, Phil Griego, who has a title insurance company, I think
he said. He did. I don't think he has it anymore.
And he votes on title insurance.
He did, yes.
And one of the things that amazed me when I first bought my house here is how little title insurance actually covers and how expensive it was.
And we had a bill when I was there that would make it do even less.
And you mentioned Tim Eichenberg, who's a property tax consultant. Basically, that's someone who I think reduces property taxes. Is that what he does?
I think he represents people contesting their property taxes.
And he votes on those.
But remember, property taxes are county taxes. They're not state taxes.
Right.
So that there's always that. And that's what the folks that lobby at the federal level, and that's what Manny said. He was lobbying other states' legislatures, not this legislature.
So a really interesting thing is the actual ethics law that was passed, which says you shall not accept anything of value that improperly influences a political act. Well, all these people, it seems to me, can say they didn't violate that. There's no conflict of interest provision. What are you talking about?
Well, I would say I'm talking about campaign contributions.
Okay, so yeah.
How about those?
let's talk about, because I think conflict of interest is sort of the tip of the iceberg, and campaign contributions is the real iceberg floating under the water.
Yeah, remember former treasurer, Robert V. Hill, when caught on videotape accepting a manila envelope filled with cash, his defense was, oh, no, that was a campaign contribution.
Right.
So this is the big question that we as voters have to decide, and that is, are these huge campaign contributions, and I tried to limit them, and it was a bitter struggle. And it continues.
Yeah, the leadership's totally against
that. The leadership was against that.
Right.
Is this legalized bribery? I mean, that's the question.
Let me mention, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, And I'm very pleased to have Dee Dee Feldman on the show. She's back. She could be my most frequent guest.
Thank you, Steve.
She's just written a book, I think, that is really excellent, Inside the New Mexico Senate. And, you know, this legalized bribery thing is something that really occurred to me, because once you consider that with these campaign contributions, you can apparently, according to what I've read, pay your mortgage, pay expenses on your car, hire your spouse as a consultant.
Well, certainly the law has been stretched. The law has been stretched. For example, I think actually the Secretary of State approved Phil Griego's use of his campaign fund for his 55 Chevy truck.
There you go.
Because this was used in parades. It's certainly very, very lax. This is a problem. And that is, our Secretary of State often doesn't have enough money and personnel to really enforce the legislation that we have on the books.
There's no ethics. I mean, it comes down to the— we're one of eight states that doesn't have an ethics commission. In other words, there's no enforcement agency to actually enforce these ethical constraints. But as I said, you know, the ethical constraints, the way it's worded, I mean, it has to be, quote, reasonably related to the campaign. I mean, that, you know, that those are weasel words.
Well, then they're interpreted by the Secretary of the State and the Attorney General sometimes. Mm-hmm. And the interpretations have been pretty lax. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm in favor of an ethics commission. I'm in favor of much tighter campaign finance reporting requirements, because the public really deserves to know. So, you know, it's really tough to get that, though, because we don't have initiative or referendum here at the state level. And so any reforms like that that you get have to come from the legislature themselves. And that's pretty tough. And so, you know, my message was never, and I don't believe these are corrupt individuals. The vast majority of people that serve in the New Mexico Senate are doing it for the right reasons. There are always bad apples, but they are good people trapped in a bad system.
But they trap themselves. I mean, you write about this. We've had commissions and task forces that, for example, say you should be paid, you should get compensation, you should get— you should have staff so you actually know what, you know, you should get $10,000 at least to be able to.
They're afraid to vote for that.
And they won't vote for it. And it suggests to me, and you're saying, I guess I'm wrong, that they get more under the table than they would get over the table, or they'd be at the— and it's the Republicans, it's the Democrats, it's the members. I mean, they will not pay themselves, which I find to be a very strange thing.
Well, they feel that if they vote to pay themselves, and remember, it's not entirely up to them, because any change in the way the compensation for legislators is made has to be through amending the Constitution. So the question that's put before the legislature is, do you favor a constitutional amendment to allow the voters to increase the— or to institute— we don't have a salary, we have a per diem— to institute a salary or to institute a stipend for legislators. And they're afraid to vote for it because they're afraid that people would say, you're feathering your own nest, and it's all how self-serving. And that's indeed what a campaign commercial would say about somebody who did vote that way.
So they all say that, you know, of course, a campaign contribution would never influence my vote. And one of the interesting things about your book is you go through several situations where—
The data is very clear.
Yeah.
The data is very clear.
Where there arguably is influence. And I want to talk to you about one quickly, actually, and that is the example of limiting fireworks sales. Because this seems on the surface to be a no-brainer, that when things are dry and there's a great risk of fire, there have been fires, there have been a fire in your district.
Yes, and the wording was extreme fire danger.
So we don't have a lot of time to do it, but, you know, in 2012, you come forward, you even get the governor to go along with you. So now you've got Republicans, you've got Democrats, you've got all the municipalities,
All the firemen were in the audience there with their uniforms.
And I think you end up concluding that special interests overcame the public interest, and specifically campaign contributions. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Well, there were not as many campaign contributions in that case, but they were very well targeted. You see, it's very easy to stop something in the New Mexico legislature if you target your contributions onto the committee that this measure has to pass through. So, you know, just to be fair, I mean, the trial lawyers give all of their money to the judiciary committees.
Right. I mean, this is something they all do.
Yeah. And the corporations to the Corporation Commission and to and so on. And so if you have a smart lobbyist that has targeted the campaign contributions to that particular committee, that's where that measure will stop. And the fireworks measure stopped three or four times in the same committee.
So can you give us an example of what you're talking about in terms of campaign contributions? You talk about it in your book.
Well, in terms of how big does the campaign contribution have to be?
Exactly.
Well, we're a cheap date here in New Mexico. It actually, compared to California or New York or someplace where it really costs a lot to run a campaign, here I think the median cost of a campaign for a senator is probably something like $40,000. And in the contested ones, it's different. But $40,000, it would be it.
So how much of a campaign contribution?
So a $250 campaign contribution is pretty big.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's pretty big. And you don't forget who gave you a
$250. And if you get it year after year from the same source.
Yes, and if the lobbyist, for example, helps you raise money from other lobbyists or helps you have a party and pays the expenses for the party, then the lobbyist is almost acting like an arm of an individual senator's campaign. And I really think that's very dangerous.
So another thing I just have to bring up, because I think listeners will be fascinated by it, is we always hear about lunches and dinners. And you talk with the fireworks legislation, you talk about these elaborate meals that were brought in by lobbyists.
It's the Corporations Committee that had very, very fancy dinners with, you know, linen tablecloths. And it's really, you know, my own committee, the Public Affairs Committee, also sometimes had dinners brought in because we were there. We met sometimes from 3:30 until 10 at night. So if we took
to have dinner.
Well, if we took a break, I'd be afraid I'd lose the rest of the committee and we couldn't establish a quorum. So we sometimes had it. But it's really once again, because time is so compressed in the Senate, things are at the last minute and it's all jammed up. We should have a more regular schedule, you know, with dinner breaks and so on. So then the lobbyists perhaps would not have quite as much power.
So they brought in – so they had some very nice dinners expensive. Right.
Oh, yes. Santa Fe has some very wonderful restaurants. Really wonderful. And unfortunately, all the people in the audience have been there waiting for their bill to be heard. They've been there for 3 hours sometimes. So they're watching the senators and the House members. This not just applies to the Senate. Eat these sumptuous meals while they're the peons looking on.
We're nearing the end of the show, so I want to ask you what I admit is a very unfair question.
Gee, thanks.
Zero being no influence, 10 being having a major impact. Conflicts of interest, campaign contributions. How much impact does unethical play in the process?
I give it a 7.
Well, that's an incredibly high score.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being my guest, for answering my unfair questions. You've been listening to Dee Dee Feldman. She's written a book, which I thoroughly enjoyed, Inside the New Mexico Senate. I would also like to thank my producer, Jefferson White. The executive producer of this show is Lynn Chebecki. My name is Stephen Spitz. Podcasts of this show are available on iTunes under Stephen Spitz. Archives of all my past shows are available at stephenspitz.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.